end, the being there. One said God is beyond reason. Nietzsche said God is against reason, and Heidegger says irrelevant. The most great thinkers had an early and a later stage. There was an early and later Plato. There's an early and later Aristotle. There's an early and later Wittgenstein. I'll pass on speculating as to why that is. Presumably, things are supposed to get better in the later stage. Often they got worse in the later stage. But at any rate, his early stage was anthropological. His later stage was hermeneutical. In his early stage, he has a heavy style, and later stage, a freer and lighter one. The early one is represented by being and time, and the later one by introduction to metaphysics. In the early stage, he stressed dread. In the later stage, joy. The early approach was more phenomenological, and the latter approach was more mystical, which to me is where phenomenology leads. There is a unity, however, in his thought. There fallen, forfeiture, or forgetting being. That's true. The man's major problem is his there fallenness, his forgotten being. His interest in or quest for being and overcoming nihilism. He's not happy with Nietzsche, and throughout his entire life he's in a quest for being and overcoming nihilism. First, the early Heidegger, being and time, the anthropomorphic. This is a massive phenomenological analysis of human being, Dasein, the being there, in quest for being. So you have Dasein in quest for sein. Part one, man's inauthentic everyday existence has three fundamental aspects, three essential things about you, facticity, existentiality, and forfeiture. Facticity, man finds himself cast in a world not of his own willing. It's my world. I make it. Man is homo faber, before he's homo sapiens. Some say sapiens. I like sapiens. The world is mine to make within the limits of my contingency. The world is the common sphere of activity and interest, the mental world, the phenomenal world, the world to me. So the world to me is there. I can make it. I can do it. I can draw pictures, write books, whatever I want. That's one fact about me. I can't help it. It's just there. Existentiality. It is the act of appropriating or making the world mine. Now, here I am. The lot in life is to roll a rock up the hill to let it roll down the hill. That's all I can do. So what do? I can either fight it or make it mine. And I can gain my meaning in assuming it is my project. Hey, that's what I got to do forever? Shovel dirt into prison? I'll make that my project and gain my meaning by the absurdity of what I have to do over and over. That's why he's saluting on the deck of the ship while Sartre is drinking below. It is an interpersonal existence which stones do not have. Man is an anticipation, always reaching beyond himself, though within the bounds of the world. Man's project in, of, and with, he projects in, of, and with his world. Existentiality is the anticipation of the world and an understanding of it by, of course, giving meaning to it. Third fundamental fact about man is forfeiture, ver fallenness. Through man's self-projection and self-transcendence, man understands the world and becomes himself. But the world is not only the material for our creative energy, but also the agent by which we are seduced from our essential drive to understand and to create. That is, we not only shape our world, but we forfeit to it. We forget being in our quest for particular being. We end up thinking about this being, or this school, or that book, or this course, and we forget about the most important thing, being. Don't lose being in your quest for being, Heidegger says. We sacrifice I for they. We seek meaning of human beings in the anonymous crowd, das man. You won't find meaning in das man. You find meaning in Dasein, because he's the key to Sein. In the inauthentic public mode that is alienated from one's own true becoming. Conclusion, man is determined. We're put here, yet free to make of the world what we will. But the all-essential I is hidden most of life by the daily routine. The tension of the historical, for example, the call of my situation, my family, and my country, calls me away from being. The unhistorical, passing moods, gossip with the neighbor, flight from the self, of the self from the self. That's our major problem. We're fleeing from ourself, in ourself, and we should use ourselves as the means to get back to being. That's the early Heidegger. We'll take the later Heidegger then. The second part of Heidegger's philosophy from being in time. He says, against this scattering inauthenticity, I'm going to single out authentic being, Dasein, and I'm going to develop the concept of existential or historical time, which involves three things: dread, conscience, and destiny. And Heidegger develops these three concepts in the following way. Dread is a momentary state of mind, the answer to whether we can emerge from forfeiture, that is, turn back in the flight from ourselves with honesty. The most unique momentary state of mind is dread, which recalls man from self-betrayal to self-knowledge. Now, here's the best statement in the paragraph. Dread is an objectless fear, a sense of nothingness that grasps me when I face the whole as a whole, the whole of it as ending in death. His most famous concept is that I am a being unto death. I am born, and I'm headed for nothingness. I didn't choose to be born. There's this ultimate nothingness facing me. It's an objectless fear, and I dread it. I don't know what it is. I don't know where I'm going, and I'm headed there headlong for destruction. It sets us. Then he goes on to say, hence, I dread my life as a whole because it is bounded and grounded in death. So dread reveals that we are a being unto death. It sets us free from the illusion of the they, because it's the I. I am dying. I am heading for death. So dread brings me to the totality of my authentic being, namely to my death. Thus, death is the only event in my life that is uniquely mine. Now, in the light, yes, this is angst. This is what he means. Conscience fits in with this. Dread is the mood in which man is open to the voice of conscience. Now you realize that you come from nothing, you're headed to nothingness, that it's inevitable and unavoidable, and you have this fear, then you hear the call of conscience. What is this conscience? It is the voice of the self to itself, calling it from forgetfulness to responsibility, calling it from the amnesia toward being to being itself. It is a call from inauthenticity. It must recognize that we are thrown into the world not of our own choosing, and yet it is precisely this condition that I must choose. So the conscience bids us to transcend our own facticity and enslavement to freedom. It tells me I ought to face my contingency and make it vitally mine rather than let it inflict itself upon me. Don't let that necessity of rolling the rock up the hill inflict itself on you. Inflict yourself on it. So through the conscience, I recognize myself in debt to myself, that is, guilty. This is not a moral guilt, mind you. This is an existential guilt. This is a guilt that comes from realizing that you are headed toward nothingness, have a dread for it, and have a responsibility to affirm yourself in the face of it, to stand on the deck of the ship and salute. Destiny. Death is my destiny. Existential time is my time. That is, from birth to death. Time is the ontological ground of what man most truly is. Time, contrary to what you might think, moves from the future to the present. It doesn't move from the past to the present. Now, just think about that for a moment. That is exactly right. Time moves from the future, because where is the next moment? The moments are coming into me. The moments aren't going away from me. So time moves from the future. Every moment I live, I'm taking a piece of the future. A new piece of the future. So time moves from the future to the present. It doesn't move from the past to the future. Time's a very fascinating thing. We could get involved in a physical dissertation here of time, too. Only by choosing my time and the role into which I have been cast am I properly historical. That is, I have a destiny. So our time was given for, but not by our own duty. We are given time and we are responsible to it by choosing it, and that's how we become historical. Conclusion, Being in Time pictures the lonely will driven by dread to face the prospect of its own nothingness and in retrospect its own guilt, and yet to realize in this the terror of its own freedom. That's Heidegger A, early Heidegger. Now the later Heidegger is of more interest to us. By the way, the early Heidegger has a stronger influence on, let's say, Paul Tillich and his ground of being. You find the grounding of Dasein is in Sein. The grounding of my being is in the ground of all being. The later Heidegger has more of an influence on Bultmann because of his hermeneutic. So Heidegger is one person with two great periods who influenced two great movements, the demythology New Testament movement and the Paul Tillich ground of being movement. Later Heidegger, exposition, a hermeneutical emphasis, and it's from his book, The Introduction to Metaphysics. He talks about history. The meaning of being is rooted in the intellectual history of the West. Being as distinct from particular things is almost nothing, a haze, as Nietzsche said. We have fallen out of being and betrayed our true vocation by running foolishly after this thing and that thing. So it is the history of our being that we should be forgetful about being. That's kind of his summary of Western history. We've forgotten being. The pre-Socratics, however, knew it. And we'll see, that's why he uses the etymological method for meaning. That's why Kittel is based on this whole thing. Because if we want to get back to what being really is, we have to get back to the original understanding of that word. And the original understanding of Greek comes from the earliest Greeks. So you go back to the pre-Socratic philosophers, they are the ones who truly understood being, and you study the etymology of the word until you get back there, and there is where being has really revealed itself. Second concept, the darkening of the world. We live in a world darkened by our forgetfulness of being. We are more concerned about being, from genes to spaceships, than with our true calling, which is to be shepherds and watchers of being. Inventiveness, not understanding, has been our occupation. We are more concerned with proliferation of technological skills than with metaphysical unity. So we have lost being. It has become a haze, an error, a nothingness. There's a lot of truth to that. Modern man, since Kant, hasn't been interested in metaphysics. He built the gulf and locked us on the other side. Should be no surprise why we're not interested in metaphysics. We're more interested in things, beings, particulars. But a man's life consists not in the abundance of the beings which he possesses, to rephrase Jesus. We ought to look to being, the reality, the whole. We don't do metaphysics anymore. We just do physics. We don't look at the spiritual realm. We're looking just at the phenomenal realm. The Greek philosophy is the help. It's the salvation. Greek philosophy. Philosophy can only be done properly in Greek and German. Latinizing Greek philosophy has become the source of all error. Now, when the Latins took over, they Latinized it. They essentialized it. If you get back to the true, original German and Greek understanding of language, that's where you get the meaning of things. In fact, between Parmenides and Aristotle, the error began, namely a dichotomy between being and thought. For Parmenides, these were one. Now notice to whom he's calling us back. Father Parmenides, who was he? A monist, a pantheist. And notice the implicit philosophy in calling us back to the etymology of language. If the etymology is the original pure meaning, and its history distorted it, then whatever philosophy the original people had will be reflected in their language, then you're really indirectly buying into their philosophy. And if you look back to the philosophy of the pre-Socratics, they were largely mystical, pantheistic, what have you. So in this subtle way, you're going to be buying into their mysticism or pantheism because what they literally meant by that word in their context will reflect their thinking and their worldview, which happened to be pantheism or mysticism. In the So he calls back to Parmenides. For Parmenides, these were one. Even Heraclitus, who said no man steps into the same river twice, held the unity of being in the Logos. But by the time of Aristotle, being had broken loose from its first great anchorage and floated out in that tide of nihilism on which we are still adrift. Man has become a rational animal who merely has a logos but is not at home in being. We have lost the pre-Socratic aletheia. Now, what is the literal etymological meaning of aletheia, which is the Greek word for truth? But what is the, it's made up of two words, and what do they mean? A, which means no or on, and aletheia. No kittle, yeah. Cuddle up with kittle. Could be translated literally unhiddenness. The unhiddenness of being. A truth has become a characteristic of propositions, mere correspondence with the facts. So he's rejecting a correspondence view of truth by going back to the etymology of aletheia, is unhiddenness, and he's saying what they originally meant by truth was just let being be. Just let being express itself. Just undisclose it. Pull the veil from in front of it and let it reveal itself. In other words, go back to native consciousness, awareness, the whole pantheism, the phenomenology from Hegel on, in fact, even before that, Plotinus and the later Plato. This loosening of truth from being has led to nihilism. And then he gets into poetry and language, which becomes interesting for us. Heidegger wishes to recall us from nihilism to being through language. How do I get at this original being? I get at it through the being who is there, but he is not just the being there, he's the being who speaks. So human language is the key to understanding being. It is by language that man stands open to being. Unlike pseudo-terminology of science, which has lost its hold on being, the true origin of language is in poetry. For poetry is the primal language and historical people in which it found being. Hence, the great poets are the ones who can restore language to its primal power as a revealer of being. Thus, language is the foundation and house of being, especially the poetic language of Holderlin, who had a keen tie with classical antiquity. Through him, we may hope to get some mittances of truth, some illumination of being, of the holy. We are, as it were, waiting for God. Compare Beckett's play, Waiting for Godot. A God remote from theology or piety who presides over the long-lost being of which we are in quest. So what did he do? He went out in the Black Forest, read Holderlin, and waited for mittances of truth to come through. Or German, of course, if you want to do it in German, read Goethe, who's also a pantheistic poet, read Goethe and let mittances of truth. In fact, Tesla was reading Goethe when he got the vision for the internal workings of the alternating current motor. That's how he invented it. Pardon? Yeah, and the alter AC motor, too. The internal workings of the AC motor, he was reading Goethe and got a vision of the workings of it. Kekulé had a vision of a snake biting its tail and invented the model for the benzene molecule. There's a lot of fascinating, quote, modern inventions that have come from this, and Heidegger suggests that get back in the Black Forest or wherever, get yourself a poet who's in touch with the pre-Socratics or the ancients, and let being be. Let it come forth and grab some of these mittances of truth, because language is the key